All right, good evening. Welcome to the reconstituted post-Pesach Shiur, which we're going to have a look at Megillat Ruth. We're going to start looking at the Book of Ruth, hopefully to finish by Shavuos, but the more you look at this book, it's just so overwhelming. So overwhelming in so many ways. But before we do that, I just want to make one dedication. In fact, two dedications. Number one, I had Yortzeit yesterday, so I want to dedicate the Shiur memory of my mother, Yetta Bas Yisrael, who passed away in the year 2000, 13 years, so been a bit of time. But it's very fitting, the Book of Ruth, with all the issues of chesed and doing kindness. And she was a woman who really lived and breathed the concept of chesed her whole life. So I want to dedicate the Shiur to her. And obviously we've just gone through Yom HaShoah, and we can add that dedication as well, that our learning should be to the Elohi, if we can say such a thing, of neshamot, of all those endless stories and numbers that we just can't get our head around, of people whose lives were just snuffed out in such a cruel way. And really, I think it's a season to maybe to think a bit about that. We're in the Omer period, and it's one of those things that we do think about. Before we start, I just want to give a bit of Sfarim background, because it's always worth talking about the books. There was, in the 1980s, essentially from the 1960s onwards, a wonderful teacher in Israel who I had the privilege of hearing, not very often, but I heard once or twice, somebody called Yeshua Bachrach. Rav Bachrach was a teacher. I mentioned him in the shurim that we learned on Sefer Shmur. And he was a teacher in Michlala and in many, many places in Eretz Yisrael. And it was a short man, sort of yeki with a bit of a beard, you know, sort of like very Germanic gentleman. And his stuff is just so spectacular. I can't begin to bring it into this year, because then we'll be doing the Book of Ruth in the next 5 years. There's so much material. But occasionally I'll share with you some thoughts, some of the things that he says, because it's very special. Some of you may have the book at home. What I would suggest, you know, if you have this, or maybe some of your kids, if they went through Bat Mitzvah, it's a very popular book. I've got the Hebrew version, Ima Shel Malchut. And in English, it's called Mother of Royalty. It's the only book they ever translated of Bachra. And the only reason why he hasn't translated any of the other books, because they realize you can't translate this stuff. This has to be studied in the original. You can't do it any other way. The translation just doesn't really hold together, because he talks in concepts. It's not just a commentary like Rashi explaining the words. He is conceptual in the biggest sense that you can imagine. So I'll try and share with you some of his stuff. And the other sefer which I want to mention, which is really important, and this is somebody who's not well known, is a sefer called Nachlas Yosef. Nachlas Yosef, the gentleman's name was Yosef Zev Lipowitz. Lipowitz is not a name that is well known, but if I say to you that he was together with Rav Soloveitchik, and with Nechama Leibovitz, and with Reb Hudna, and a whole bunch of other people in Berlin in the 1930s, then you begin to see that this man was not a lightweight. Right? What happened to him is that after, once Nazis came to power, maybe even before, he saw the writing on the wall, and he left, and he made Aliyah. And he lived in Eretz Yisrael. He died in the 1960s, if I'm not mistaken, and he ran a pension. Pension is this wonderful concept. It's a boarding house. It's basically like a place where you go in Tel Aviv. And you imagine that, you know, you go sort of to the normal place that you go for a vacation, and you end up meeting a Talmud Chacham like this. It must have been quite unbelievable. And in his writings, not many of his writings have survived, but for reasons, I don't know, maybe they're still in manuscript, I'm not quite sure, I haven't gone into that. But there is a little piece, if you know the book From Berlin to Jerusalem by, I think it's called that, by Hillel Goldberg, who is Rabbi Shulman from Shomrei Torah originally, the assistant rabbi a few years ago, Tehila Shulman, Tamima, what was her name? Tehila, Tamima. Her father is, he runs a newspaper in Denver, Hillel Goldberg. I don't know if he came to Shomrei Torah ever, very interesting gentleman. He wrote this book about these rabbis who were all together, personalities in Berlin around that particular time, studying in the University of Berlin, philosophy, and who knows what else. Okay, and it's an interesting book to read, and he gets a chapter. Rabbi Lipowitz gets a chapter in that book as well. So his book on Megillat Ruth, Nachlat Yosef, is really also beautiful. It's poetry. This is not just a sefer, again, to comment, but it's conceptual. So between these two guys, between Rav Bachrach and Rav Leibowitz, if we ever get through anything, it'll be a miracle. But we'll try. We'll try and sort of get through our pace, which is normally a perek a week. We'll see how it goes. We've got 4 or 5 weeks. I just want to... maybe we'll leave that at the end. We'll have to discuss next week because it's Yom HaTzmaut, and we'll talk about that right at the end. One introduction before we start, because I have to sort of set the groundwork. And it fits beautifully. The Book of Ruth is a wonderful book which fits to what we've studied previously. Not only what we recently studied, the Sefer Yehoshua, which we just finished, but right back at the beginning of the whole series, the Book of Shoftim. And the Book of Shoftim is a book which describes tremendous ups and downs of the Jewish people. They had good times and they had bad times, and in the good times they had a shofet, a leader, they were strong, and in the bad times they went down, they started doing idolatry and all this sort of stuff, and the society was very topsy-turvy, was very, very unstable. And you had this running for about 360 years. It was going on for a very long time. In the middle of all of that, you've got this Sefer Ruth, the Book of Ruth. Now in our canon, meaning in our Bible, the Jewish Bible, it's actually put as a separate, like you've got the book here, which you're holding, the Chamesh Megillot. The five Megillot are put as a separate section. They're in Ketuvim. And why are they in Ketuvim? Because they go according to the season of the year. Starts off with Esther, then you go to Shir HaShirim, then you go to Ruth, right? You can see the Yomim Tovim, Purim, Pesach, Shavuos, and then you go Eicha, and then finally Koheles, which is Sukkos, right? And that's the way we have it in the Jewish Bible. In the Christian Bible, it's very interesting. And what they've done is taken the Book of Ruth and put it next to the Book of Judges. You end the Book of Shoftim, and then immediately you've got the Book of Ruth. And there's a certain seichel in that, I have to admit. And I really, you know, if one can say such a thing, and not get struck down with thunder and lightning, I hope that one can suggest that there is a logic to that. Because the Book of Ruth coming straight at the end of the Book of Judges, the Book of Shoftim, is really, really important. And as we go through this, what I want to do is to suggest to you that we're going to learn this on two levels. We're going to learn it on what I call the small picture, all right? The small level meaning the actual story, the very pleasant, pastoral, how you're going to describe this story. You know, you can think of different adjectives to describe it. And also the much bigger picture. And what I'm going to already tell you to do, those of you who have it at home, and I hope a lot of you do, is the introduction of the Art Scroll Megillah. The Art Scroll Megillah series was the first books that Art Scroll came out with in the 1970s. It must be the late 70s. They did Shir HaShirim, was number one. And I think Esther was number two. And Ruth, I think, was number three. And then you got the whole box. And then from there, it's just mushroomed into thousands of books. And if you look at that Hakdama, it's excellent, excellent introduction, which we will talk about, Mitzvah Hashem, right at the end, when we get to the end of the Sefer. But if you want to do a bit of reading, preparation, if you have it at home, and if you don't have it, it's a book that is really worth getting hold of, the Art Scroll version of the Book of Ruth, the introduction. Because that is big picture. It really does lay some foundations there to understand the concept of what the Book of Ruth is trying to do. All right, so that's just by way of introduction, and it's very hard to give an introduction to this Sefer. I could stand here literally for an hour just talking introduction, and I don't want to do that. Because I want to get into the book, and then from within, we'll discover some of these great ideas and some of these beautiful concepts that we will, you know, again, we all know the story, but there's a lot of mining to go on here, right? A lot of digging. And we have to start digging from the beginning. What I propose is really that we will learn through the Sefer, verse by verse, as we have done in the past with our other learning. And as we go through this, maybe point out certain he'arot, certain issues that really need more attention. There are halachic issues that I can't begin to deal with reasonably at this time. I mean, we'll have to talk a bit about the status of conversion in those days, because that comes up in the book. Yibum right at the end, what exactly is going on with the Goel, the Redeemer. That's something that, again, we'll have to do it. Again, if you're interested in literature, there's a Rosh Yeshiva was here recently from the Gush called Yaakov Medan. And he's written a book on Sefer Ruth, and he discusses these issues from halachic, hashkafic perspective. And that's another book, but that's only available. Good evening. That's only available in Hebrew, but again, a very useful book to lay your hands on if you can. So there's a lot of material, a lot of reading, a lot of stuff to do in the background, which will enhance what you're learning here.
The way I'm, as I said, we're going to look at it, small picture, big picture, and I think that's the way I want to go. Small picture meaning actually getting to into the learning of the story. Big picture, seeing what the story represents, what is this book all about? And before we start learning, the obvious question to ask, who wrote it? Who was the author of the Book of Ruth? Anyone want to be brave enough to suggest the name? Who wrote it? The answer is Shmuel HaNavi. Shmuel HaNavi wrote the Book of Judges, he wrote the Book of Ruth, and he wrote a bit of the Book of Shmuel, which is strange. The book which is named after him is the one that he didn't write the whole lot, because he dies essentially towards the end of Shmuel Aleph. And Shmuel Bet wasn't written by Shmuel at all, written by other prophets, right? But the books that he did write, the Book of Shoftim and the Book of Ruth, are very much in the style, in the hashkafa, in the outlook of Shmuel HaNavi. And I say that now as an introduction, and as we go along, you'll see what I'm getting at. Okay, I'm talking a bit in riddles at the moment, but it's the only way I can kick it off. Open up the books. I don't know what page it is in that particular brown version. 84. All right, so we'll start looking at the chapter. And as I said, we'll try and deal maybe with some of the issues as we go along. I can't do a lot of justice to it, but we'll try and sort of at least look at Perek Aleph. And maybe if we have a bit of time at the end, just to again talk a bit more in the bigger picture, right? So again, I hope you see what I'm trying to do. Small picture, big picture. And this is the small picture. We're going to see a story which has within it a tremendous amount of problematic material because of the behavior of the people. All right. As much as the Tanakh is obviously concerned with the behavior of our great leaders, in this case we have very, very serious questions about the leadership during one of the periods of the Judges. According to Chazal, Boaz is Ivtzan. Ivtzan is mentioned in chapter 12 of the Book of Judges. So it's right bang in the middle of the period of the Shoftim, of the Judges. Okay, if that's who he really is. That's the suggestion of the rabbis. So what we're looking at is essentially a commentary through the medium of a story about the time period known as the Tkufa, the period of the Judges. All right, and that's what's going on over here in the Book of Ruth. This is a story which has, as I said, a smaller picture, the actual story itself, the interactions between these various people, and what it represents in the bigger global view of the society and what was going on around them, and how they were functioning, or really not functioning, in the way that they should have done. They should have functioned so much better, and they didn't, until along comes Ruth. Ruth. Ruth is coming from left field. So left field that she's not even in the field. She's so far away, it's just unbelievable. So you'll see when we get there, you'll see exactly what I mean. Page 84, right? We're good. Let's begin. Vayehi b'yimei shvot ha-shoftim. This is very famous. The days of the judging of the judges. In other words, as you say, I suppose you say in Yiddish, everyone is an uberchochem, right? Uberchochem means that everybody knew better than everybody else. They were judging their own judges, say the rabbis. And it was a time of great stress in the Jewish people's history. The judges, as we know, even if we're talking not talking about the great judges, the great leaders, but even those would be shvot ha-shoftim, would be judged by everybody. Everybody had an opinion. Everybody sort of became very independent. They became very tribal. They became very disconnected. We began to see that at the end of the Book of Yoshua. There were elements already of the disconnect. So look what's going on here. It's a days of Shofot HaShoftim. Either when the judges are judging, the period of judges, or, as the rabbis say, that the society was judging its judges, right? They knew better. Yeah.
How much time after Yoshua?
This is very difficult to say, because my suggestion is that it doesn't matter when, how long after. But you're talking right in the middle, so let's say 150 years, right, approximately, between 150 and 200 years, right in the middle of the period of judges. The period of judges is 360 years after Yeshua died, till you get to Shmuel, Dovid HaMelech, and this is, let's say, around 150 to 200 years. Very difficult. And the time element here is kind of timeless, because it's making a comment. It's making a statement about, essentially, the whole period through the medium of this story. Okay, that's why it's a very clever sefer. It's a very smart sefer. It's smart in the sense that what's happened here, through the story, you're getting a kind of picture. How would you say today? You're getting a snapshot, right, of what's going on and the good side, but essentially the negative side. That's what we're starting with. Okay, I'm sorry the introduction is very difficult, but I'm trying my best. Listen to this again. And there was a famine. And again, it's not something that is mentioned so directly in the book of Shoftim, but this is around this time there was a famine in Eretz Yisrael. Ish mi beit lechem Yehuda. There was a man. Ish always connotes a very important person. Ish. Okay, not just in the sense of a man as opposed to a woman, but Ish in the sense, Ish Chashuv, you would say in Ivrit. Ish Chashuv, an important guy. And he's from Beit Lechem Yehuda, from Beit Lechem, in Yehuda. What did he do? Lagur b'stei Moab. He went to dwell in the fields of Moab. Hu v'ishto shnei banav. He took the ganz mishpoch, he took his wife and his two sons. Now, you say to me, so what? Alright, so he went out of Eretz Yisrael. But when you find out who he is, then it really blows your mind. And Rashi immediately says, the second Rashi, Vayelech Ish, and he picks up on this idea of Ish. It's the second comment of Rashi. I don't know if you have Rashi in front of you. Oh, you don't. That's already going to be an interesting challenge. But you'll have to take my word for it. Listen to this. Ashir Gadol Haya. He was a very rich man. Okay? And Uparnes Hador. It's very well known. He was the guy who used to... He was the leader. He was the Parnas. He was the man in charge. This guy called... We're going to find his name, Elimelech. Vayotza me'eretz Yisrael lechutz la'aretz. He left Israel. Why? Mibnei Tsarot ha'ayin. He was basically, tsarot ha'ayin literally means small eye. His eye became small. What does that mean? He became a miser. He became very negative towards people.
Narrow focus.
So narrow. He was absolutely determined to hold on to his money. And under no circumstance, even though he had been so supportive of the people at a regular time, when it came to this period of ra'av, of famine, he wanted to get out. And that was his motivation. And this is not a great praise of anybody. He's running away not only from the people, his town, his village, his shtetl and everything else, but he's running away from his responsibilities. And that is a very serious problem here. And this is what's going on. And it says, La'gur b'stei Moab, and he's going to stay Moab. You're fine. This is Reb Bachra. I'm just going to share one thought with you. He says that when we're talking about where he's coming from, it's always Beit, Bayit. Eretz Yisrael is Bayit, is a home. Where is he going? Sedeh. He's going to the field. Temporary. You don't live in a field, right? A field is where you put up a tent for a little bit of time. Hopefully you come out of the field. And you see the names of the places here. Bayit, where he's coming from, and Sedeh is where he's going to. He says Sedeh is the concept of something which is not permanent, something which is very temporary, something which is very unstable. So what is happening is that in fact, Elimelech, this gentleman, who is the leader of the generation, is taking his family into the most impossible situation. He's, as you say, from the frying pan into the fire, right? He's leaving behind a famine and he's going to Sedeh Moab. And why Moab of all places? What does the Torah say about Moab? Lo kodmu etchem b'mayim u'belechem. You were going through the desert. Who did not give you any food? The Moabites, right? They weren't friendly. They were very unfriendly. And that's why you have a problem with conversions from Moab. This is all part of the book, right? And we're going to come to that. And he wanted to go there because, you know what? They don't. The Mishalachim don't get here. That's basically what it boils down to. They won't get here. They won't knock on my door. Because they're not going to Moab. Because they're not going to get any joy from the Moabim either. So why would they bother coming here? Right? And that's basically what's going on. This is Elimelech. This is Naomi, who doesn't seem to have at the moment a voice. She will have a wonderful voice in the end, but not yet. And Shnei Bana, and he took the kinder, he took the two sons. And there's a whole question about their names, as you'll see in a minute. Were they the real names, or were these nicknames? Because the names are very difficult names, as you'll see. Pasuk Bet, we'll go on. V'shem ha'ish Elimelech, his name is Elimelech. V'shem ishto Naomi. So again, just by their names, Elimelech, you know, sort of very regal, royal name, godly name. Naomi, Naim, Noam, Dachei Noam, right? The idea of pleasant. So clearly this is, even if these are not the real names, although in this case the suggestion is that they are, obviously, but later on with the two sons, not so much, and there is this sense of royalty of in terms of their names. And what's the names of the son? V'shem Shnei Banav, Machlon v'kilion. Machlon v'kilion are not very nice names. Machlon is the idea of chole, the idea of sickness, and kilion is klia, which means destruction. All right, so that's their names, right? Not really nice names to call anybody in terms of naming. And the if I'm not mistaken, I think we find them mentioned elsewhere in Divrei Yamim, their real names, Yoash, and they had other names. So these two names were not just names that they were born with, but these were names that were given to them because of what had happened to them. They had left Eretz Israel to a place of destruction. That's where they went, and that was the name that was given to both sons, the sense of destruction and waste that they were going to. And it says, in contrast, back to the Pasuk, Ephratim. They were from Ephrat. Ephrat is another name for Beit Lechem. It's the idea also of they were very royal. Rashi says on Ephratim, Chashuvim. Ephrat is a Lashon Chashuv. They were important people. It goes on and it says, Mi Beit Lechem Yudah, again from Beit Lechem, Vayavo Sedei Moab Vayusham. And they were in the fields of Moab. And this, again, is a very serious contrast. One of the main themes of the Sefer, as everybody knows, is the issue of chesed, of kindness. And of course, what the whole beginning of the Sefer is about is the lack of chesed. Elimelech does not want to perform his responsibility towards the community of doing chesed. He wants out. And it's not clear even why he wants out. It's not sort of so clear, except if you look at it in a very personal way, there's something wrong here. As you say in Yiddish, he's fazich. He wants everything for himself, but not for Yenam. Not for somebody else. And it's a very serious problem. And look what happens. Gimel, it's tragic. Vayamot Elimelech. We're not even told that, you know, he had a time to settle down. He dies. Ish Naomi, the husband of Naomi, again suggesting this important person. Look at Rashi. Oh, you don't have Rashi. Like, just listen to what Rashi says. Lama, Nema, why is it repeat Ish Naomi? Mikan Amru, Ein Ish Met Elalishto. In this case, he did not have anyone who grieved for him except his wife. Think about it. When he was in Eretz Israel, he would have had people sort of lining up to make shiver calls, as they say. Here he's in Sedei Moav, and who is crying for him? One person, his wife. Rashi doesn't even say his children cry for him. That's very difficult. But that's the way Rashi brings from the Midrash. So that is, again, it's so difficult. This whole scenario is so complicated. Yeah.
Ask what Rashi's saying.
Correct, and you're right. Except you'll see here, there's a bracket over here in the Rashi, and there's a whole Ketav Yad issue, which I don't want to go into. Bit of homework. Have a look at the Rashi continuation, and you'll see that the continuation of Rashi goes beyond that particular interpretation. That is the pshat, but there's a Rashi. The concept here is a bit more than that, right? That really there was nobody else to mourn for him. Unbelievable. Ein Sham. I'm not going to go into that now, but it's worth having a look. So have a look at this. What's going on here? Again, she's by herself with her two sons. So it's a pretty desperate situation. At this point, something happens which is, again, it just your jaw drops when you read this.
Why
yeah.
Say a desperate situation?
It's desperate.
I would say that they were still very wealthy.
That's the question. The question is how much money they took with them. What happened there?
You're
it's not clear.
You're not going to marry princesses.
Correct. Certainly on the basis of their reputation, that's for sure. Because the whole idea of who they marry is because of who they are. Right? In other words, you know,
and the wealth.
All right, at this point, but of course you'll see it changes very quickly. By the time she goes back to Eretz Yisrael, everything is gone. Everything. She's left with one gem, but it's not a diamond, it's a daughter-in-law. All right, and that's what she's left with. But there's a moral here. But we'll come to that. Look at this. Dalet, Vayisulahem Nashim Moaviyot. Now, I'm refraining from making comments here, except to say that the pasuk is pretty clear. They married Moabite women. All right? They married women who were not Jewish. The two sons. Obviously, what had happened is that Elimelech had died, and the two sons are left, and they have gone into a way here which is very hard to explain. Now, again, if you get your hands on Art Score, get your hands on the Judaica, the book that I've got here, he brings a dozen different Mephoshim on this. And the suggestion may be that they went through some sort of conversion, and the conversion was a private conversion, not with the blessing of the rabbis, which I don't even understand how people can even bring the rabbis into this discussion if these guys have run away from Israel into a non-Jewish world with no obvious Jewishness around them. This is not like moving from Israel to New York to New Jersey. This is moving Israel to Iceland. You know that you probably find a Chabadnik in Iceland as well. But it doesn't matter. Wherever it is, you know, you're going somewhere which is. There's not. You want? I bet you there is. They're everywhere. It's amazing. Wherever you are, wherever they've gone, to worry about sort of conversions and what's going on, I just don't know. To me, it's like so blatant. In fact, there's a whole machlokus in the Midrash. There's a Rut Rabbah, which is wonderful Midrash. So the whole beauty of Book of Ruth is that it's short. So if you want to look at Midrashim, you don't have to go through like 25 pages of each chapter. You know, for 25 chapters, you've got here four prokim, and the Midrashim are beautiful. The Reb Lipowitz has got a whole section here just on the Midrashic text, and it's precious. So that's to get a bit of extra reading. A lot to do on Shavuos. It's a whole night, so you can sit and learn the rest of what I'm telling you now. But listen to this. What's going on? These guys go and marry these Moabite women. Were they converted? Were they not converted? My own personal feeling, I'm not going to try and influence you. Just the way I read it, they weren't Jewish. And they married out. As you would say today, they married out. Period. Are we going to try and salvage their reputations a little bit? The Ibn Ezra comes along and says, quite categorically, that they must have married, must have converted them. He says, his language, Ibn Ezra, I'll just read what he says. He says, Machlon v'chilion, b'lo yitaken sheikhu machlon v'chilion elu hanashim. It's not right that they would take these wives ad she'nit gairu, until they were converted. Alright, so the suggestion is, according to the Ibn Ezra, he said, it's kind of obvious that they had to be converted. But what I want you to realize is that this is not so obvious to a lot of other rabbis. And in Midrash, there's already arguments between different rabbis. Were they converted? Were they not converted? And with all due respect to Ibn Ezra, I know what he's trying to say and understand it, because it's Tutveh, you know, these are very major players, and they've left Eretz Yisrael and they've gone and married into the non-Jewish society and the Moabite society, which was so corrupt. It defies the imagination. Ruth and Orpah were the two daughters of Eglon. And if you don't know who Eglon is, go back to the book of Judges, chapter 3, and you've got this amazing story about this very heavy guy, very heavy, and Ehud with his short sword, and basically he kills him. The sword, it says, disappears into the body, and probably never seen again. I mean, it doesn't seem to come out. It's pretty revolting. Right. Yes, that's Eglon.
I'm looking at the pasuk again. I'm saying to myself, the word Lahen may not be necessary, unless you could easily have said, Be'yusun Hashem Ne'yam.
Correct. So what's Lahen?
Lahen, they brought to them.
Yeah.
They were Jewish, and he brought these two women to them, meaning unto their house, or their
as
opposed to not having it, shows that there was something that they brought.
They brought them to. And again, in the commentary here, he says what they did get from the experience, even if it wasn't absolute conversion, they got the taste of what it is to be in a completely different environment, home-wise, family-wise, to what they were coming from. Right, where Moab was just the opposite of Chesed. Everything about Moab is, you know, sort of killing people who try and take things away from you. And here, you know, certainly Ruth was overwhelmed by it. Orpah had to make the decision, and she eventually goes back. Right, so that's a good point. And there's a lot of discussion. Ibn Ezra has got another proof from famous pasuk later on. We'll talk about it a bit more.
Why haven't we used it selfishly?
And it could be for themselves without. Yeah, I as I say, there's so many opinions and ways of looking at this, and you want to read a very technical article, look at what Rav Madan says from Gush. He's got literally 30-40 pages on this, and I can't begin to summarize it. I tried to read through quite a chunk of it, and it goes backwards and forwards. Yeah.
If you don't say they were Jewish, the whole topic would be, but shouldn't even start.
Yeah, that's one of the issues, except that you later on It obviously what Ruth does when she says your God is my God, etc., is that she accepts upon herself. Yeah, yeah. And the whole question of what exactly that Yibum is it really Yibum? We'll come to all of that, right? So that's part of the issue, why they want to give them a certain status of being Jewish. What I'm reminded of here is an interesting reality situation a number of years ago. There was a story in England, which I just want to share with you very quickly. There was a woman who was converted by Rav Gorin in the 1980s. And Goran's conversions created a lot of problems outside Eretz Yisrael. In Eretz Yisrael, it was solid, totally acceptable. But what he did was he made a conditional conversion. And his conversion was that you were Jewish as long as you stayed in Israel. As soon as you left Israel, the whole conversion was null and void. Now that when what happened was this woman, Mrs. Cohen, married. She wasn't Jewish, but got converted in Israel and married a Cohen, right? Where? Not in Israel, but outside, which again was a big problem in itself. And ended up in England. And she wanted to send her child to a Jewish school. And the London Beit Din, representing the Jewish community, said no. They said that, and not just because of the Cohen and the convert, but it was going back into the whole fact that she may never have been Jewish in the first place, according to this conditional conversion. So what you have, as I said, in terms of conversions, is very difficult territory, very difficult situation. That style of Goran was abandoned by the Rabbanim. They don't do it like that anymore. And I'm actually quite relieved, because it created a lot of problems. I understood why Rav Goran did it. He wanted people to stay in Eretz Israel. That's why when I read here that they married these Moabite women in Moab, it doesn't really give me the confidence that they would have gone to the point of converting them. Right, even though the lahem is a good deal, so I'm prepared to argue the point. Yeah, okay. So listen. So that again is just like a modern application of this. How complicated these situations are. But my feeling is, it says they married Moabite women. We'll take it at face value. And what are the names? Shema Chat Orpah v'Shema Shenid Rut. So on the names, some people argue that in fact the names were given to them because they were converted. They had Moabite names that we're not even told. And Ruth, we know, is the Gematria 606. She was already chayiv in the seven mitzvahs b'nei Noah. She took on upon herself another 606, became 613. That's the name Ruth. Orpah, I'm not quite sure, but she has a very famous namesake who is on television more or less all the time. Whatever, I forgot now how the name was linked. They played around with the Orpah and the Oprah, apparently. But that's where it comes from. This is what I was told.
Wasn't
Harpo. And Harpo as well. So don't ask me what the connection is there, but Ichveis, whatever. And Vayeshu Sham Ke'eser Shanim. And in the end, they were there for 10 years, I suppose living off their savings. But as you see, you know, as time goes on, things get less and less and less. And of course, Posake is the ultimate situation. Vayomutu Gam Shnei Machlon V'Kilin. They both died. The two sons. And this woman has now lost not only her two children, but she lost her husband as well. Yeah.
Why the Gam Shneihem?
Yeah, the Gam Shneihem is also a comment here. I'm telling you, it's loaded. Look at, again, you haven't got the Rashi. We must do something about that. Maybe we'll have to get a text with Rashi. Because there's so much Rashi. Rashi asks the question, Rashi says, what does it mean, Gam? Right, which seems to always be inclusive. So he says, "B'techila loku ber mumonam." Originally, they were afflicted that they lost their money. So that's the poverty. Umetu gmaleim, and then their camels died. Umakleim v'acharkach metu gamhem. So gam meaning one tragedy after the other. Okay, and that's the suggestion here of what happened, the gam. So that's the Rashi's interpretation. Yeah. And that's the Ke'eser Shanim, yeah, also, yeah, which again is very interesting. There are offshoots, and as I said, that we could take this whole Sefer in a halachic direction, which I'm trying to avoid for reasons that it's very complicated. Okay, not that I don't want to teach it, but I think that I want to stick to the, as I said, to the story, because the storyline in itself has got so much beauty in it, so much chayin, that I think that's what we'll get the most out of. As I said, also there's the bigger picture, which we'll talk about from time to time. So have a look at this pasuk va, and I'm going to try and get to the end of the chapter. Vatokam hi v'kalotea v'tosha mistei moav. So this, and now they're at the point of return. They've got to go back. Ki shama b'stei moav ki pakar Hashem et amo letet lehem lechem, that there is bread in Eretz Israel. She heard that God had visited the people. In other words, that the famine was over. So there's a whole discussion again amongst the rabbis. Was it because of purely going to get bread that she wanted to return, or did she really want to go back to Eretz Israel? She felt that, you know, after all these years, that it was time to return. It's a whole complication
she
here.
She heard, because she just heard, I mean, 10 years, it's more than 10 years.
Yeah.
That's a long time for a famine.
For famine, correct.
Nobody left.
Correct. So obviously had gone out before, but the connection, the lines of communication were obviously not there, but you would have had people traveling to and fro. Obviously, she's waiting to a certain point, one understands, before she goes back, that she can, you know, save face. She wants to go back, but she doesn't want to go back, sort of admitting defeat. You know, there is a psychology here. She's waiting. Okay, but there comes a point where she can't wait anymore. And this is the point. This is the tipping point. But it's very delicate. You feel for her. You know, she didn't have a voice to leave Eretz Israel, but coming back to Eretz Israel, she wants to do it, but it's very difficult. As you see, you know, her famous Mar. My name's not Naomi, it's Mar. Right, the opposite. It's not Naim, but it's Mar. It's not nice, but it's bitter. And that's what she says. Pasuk Zayin. V'tetzei min ha'makom asher hayta shama shtei kalotea. Imar, so she left the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law. V'teilachna baderech l'shuv el Eretz Yehuda. They went to go back to Eretz Yehuda. That was the to try and rectify the situation and to get back there. And again, she probably needed the family support. That was the other issue here, right? That she's out in the cold. You girls go home. Now again, if they had converted properly, how can she send them home at this point? You don't send a convert back to their original dera, all right? You keep them in the fold. So that's why people talk about conditional conversions over here, that it was depending on their sense of commitment. That's why I mentioned this whole thing with Rav Goren, how dangerous conditional conversions can be. Because the rabbis start talking about conditional conversion, that the conversion was, if they were converted, on condition that they would prove their sincerity. So who was sincere? Ruth. Who wasn't sincere? Orpah. Right? And that's one of the suggestions of how the whole system worked. If you're talking about conversion, the whole style of conversion in biblical days, Shlomo HaMelech is married to 1,000 women, none of whom are Jewish, right? And none of his wives are Jewish. They all, according to Rambam, they converted. But what was going on? If you remember, when we learned about Shlomo HaMelech, we asked the question, who lit the Shabbos candles in the palace? And the answer is only one person. Not any of the wives, it was Shlomo, right? Nobody else knew what to do. They didn't have a clue. They were in the harem. They were sort of waiting for him to visit them once every 3 years, or whatever it was, 1,000 women. So it's a crazy scene. So I don't know what to say about the whole issue of conversion. As I said, it's complicated. But let's put that to one side. So basically, she tells the girls to go back. And Yaseh Hashem Imachem Chesed. The first word, key word, that we will have again and again and again. One of the obvious key words is the word Chesed. The idea of kindness. May God do kindness to you, kasher asitim imamitim v'modi, as you did to me. That's her blessing. All right, to them. Go home. Yitain, and she elaborates. Yitain Hashem lochem. May God give you motzena menucha, isha beit isha, that you will find comfort or resting place in the house of a husband. In other words, you'll get married again. Vatishak lahem. She kissed them. Vatisena kolam v'tivkenon. They started crying. You know, you can imagine the scene. Terrible. But again, compare this type of presentation to anything that we saw in Sefer Yehoshua. It's nothing like this. Anything that we saw in Sefer Shoftim. Sefer Shoftim, it's bluster, and it's battles, and it's this and that. And, you know, and it's the Sisera getting killed by this one. And in Sefer Yehoshua, it's Yericho, and it's Ai, and it's Meimarom, and all those places. And here we've got this very personal, emotional story. You know, it's so different. It's a contrast. And that's what makes it so special. Because it's not dealing with the bluster and the power of the story that we've read in all the other books. It's dealing with the grassroots, the bottom line, as we would say, the everyday stuff. Which, of course, in our perspective, is probably the most important thing. And at this point, they're crying. And we'll sort of elaborate on those ideas as well in due course. Bear with me, we're just going to get through this. Initially they said, we'll go back with you. Alright, we're not going to leave you alone. They feel connected to her. So she said, go back. Why come with me? In other words, you're looking for husbands, you're not getting them from me. I'm an old woman. I don't have any women left, any children left in my womb. Apparently, according to Chazal, she even had a miscarriage there as well. So she lost another child on top of that. That's why she talks about this idea even of conceiving another child. She says she can't do it anymore. Shov no benotai lechna, she says, go back, my daughters. Ki zakanti miyot le'ish, I'm too old to get married. Ki amati yeshli tikva, Gam ha'iti alayla ish gam halatzi ben. In other words, have I said there's any hope that I would find someone tonight to be with, that would I would have a chance? In other words, she's saying to them, this is avud, it's lost.
Is this when we learned that you're supposed to discourage a ger, potential ger, three times?
It's three times.
Correct.
The word shovna, and we're going to talk about that as well.
That makes it sound like yeah. They didn't convert yet. She's trying to discourage.
Correct, and discouraging them. So, this is, in other words, the whole conversion issue is like a football. It's getting a soccer ball. Excuse me, not that shape. It's getting kicked around all over the place, right?
And shovna,
yeah. And there's Gemara in Yevamot about this, about the whole system of how you put off converts. I'll have to share my conversion stories, but on another occasion. I've got one story to tell you, but not now. So listen to this, Yud Gimel. Halahein tesaberna ad asher yigdal. In other words, will you wait till they grow up? If I would have children, it will be, you'd have to wait another 30 years. You're not going to wait. Halahein ta'agena bilbuti yod le'ish. In other words, are you going to be agunot? Are you just going to wait till a man comes along? Of any of the children that I may have? Albanotai ki marli mod. Says it's so bitter. Mikem ki yatsa bi yad Hashem. Right? And it's so interesting. Rebbe Elopian, the very great Baal Musa, was absolutely insistent when somebody would come to him and say, and he would say, was Herzog, or Manishma, as you say in Ivrit, and somebody would say, Raz, had a really bad time. He would say, Ein Omrim Ra, Mezognish, that is Schlecht. He says, Mezog, bitter. He says that you say that the word, that the experience is bitter. Bitter means that sometimes you have to take like a pill, it can be bitter. But hopefully, the bitterness will, the pill will actually make you better in the end. All right, that's the hope. That's at least the idea. So the word mar is, again, I feel very significant here. She's got a hashkafic point of view. She's saying that she's been through all these terrible experiences. It's mar. It's not. It doesn't use the word ra, but she says mar, bitter, and she wants to be called mara, right? And again, I find that very, very interesting. There are sort of nuances within the language here. Yudalan. Vatisena kolam vatikena od vatishakla Orpah lachamotah. So Orpah decides to go home. Verut dafkaba, and Rut cleaves to her. And Orpah, again, midrashically, she goes back and she falls straight into the Moabite way of life. And of course, later on, who becomes the grandson, the great grandson of Orpah? None other than the guy himself, Goliath, right? And who is the great grandson of Ruth? David. They meet again down the line. And that's going to be another issue we're going to deal with. Tetva. In other words, they use the word yivimtech, which maybe we'll come back to next time because I don't want to deal with it now. But the idea of the two sisters. One sister's gone home, so Ruth says, Naomi says to Ruth, go follow your sister. Ruth says, don't, leave me alone. I should go away from you. I'm not going to do it. Famous pasuk, where you go, I will go. Where you will stay, I will stay. And these are all references to different halachot. Like, for instance, the idea of talini, the place where you stay, a house, you've got to have a mezuzah, so she commits herself to putting a mezuzah on the door. And I commit myself to the God of Israel, meaning I won't be idolatrous, which obviously suggests that till now she hasn't made a full commitment, but this is now her commitment. Kash bashet hamuti amut, I will die where you die. In other words, I'll have a kavura Yisrael in a Jewish burial. V'shame kaver ko yaseh Hashem, so may the Lord do. V'kol yosef li v'kol yosef ki amavet yavri benim enecha, only death can separate between us. V'teira ki mitametzet hi lalechet itasa tsunami so, she still insisted, right? This again, back to the idea of the geirus, right? The convert. You don't push the convert away too much. There comes a point where you've got to let them sort of follow their dream. And v'techdaleda be'ema, she stops speaking to her on this subject. V'teilachna shedeyem, they both go together. Ad bo'ena beit lachem, they come back to buy it, to beit lachem. Yeah, very quickly.
What made Ruth suddenly see the light.
Yeah, and that's part of what she experienced. We spoke about that a bit before. In the home, she saw something there which she wanted to join. She wanted to be part of. This is always the big question when you meet someone who converts. You say, what brought you to Jewish life? You ask the question. All right, I haven't had the discussion, for instance, with Janusz, but I know, I think there's some Jewish ancestors somewhere down the line there. I really do, coming from Poland. But a lot of people argue that the neshama comes from the Erev of Rav. They were at Har Sinai, and they had an experience that the neshama saw something which stayed within. And it's there. And every so often, you know, you get a generation that gets a boost. Something happens. They interact with someone Jewish. And the next thing you know, they want to become Jewish. You see this. I see this in college. There's a number of kids that there's a black guy that came to me a few months ago, said he wants to convert. I sent him off to, I never heard from him again, but he turned up one day. He was very interested. It's coming from places and from backgrounds and from all different places. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. So the whole area of conversion is a very difficult question. To answer your question, what made Ruth see the light is complicated, right? But again, being in the Jewish home, experiencing what Naomi had done, there's clearly something going on here which was very significant for Ruth. Very significant. That's about as much as I can answer that one.
Does anybody say that until launching Nessus Agadola, conversion was much more lax? I wouldn't say lax. It was much easier.
It was easier.
In a case like Ruth, she can convert without a base.
Yeah, but that's the point. Could she? That's the question. And that's going to be tied up with the whole issue, because she was Ammonite or Moabite in this case. They hadn't yet decided that Moabite women could even become Jewish. Because remember, till Ruth comes along, the whole concept of the Moabite is out.
Once they make that decision, no base then would be needed as long as...
Correct. So that's part of what the whole book is about. That's the bigger picture. Shmuel HaNavi is the man who makes that decision. He's the one who makes Ruth kosher. But of course, he wasn't living at the time of Ruth. So Ruth was converted, Boaz, you know, for that particular purpose. And then they got married, and then he died straight away, more or less. That's an unbelievable story in itself. We'll deal with that next time. And what happens there is that Shmuel comes along many years later, when they're doubting that David, the descendant of Ruth, is going to be a kosher Jew. The Doeg Adomi says he's not even Jewish, because Ruth is a Moabite. What are you doing appointing a king of Israel, Shmuel, who's not Jewish? And there's a big fight going on in the Bet Din. And Shmuel, his Beis Din, makes an announcement, Moav velo Moavis, right? That we don't, Moavi velo Moavis, we don't allow the males, but we allow the female. And that is part of what this whole book is really about. Giving Ruth the final Hechsha, right, that she is a kosher Jew. And that in itself is a major, major item. And the whole question of conversion, because there were periods when conversion was easier, other periods where conversion was not so easy, wasn't encouraged. Because conversion was, you know, sometimes the motivation is always, well, in all conversions, the motivation is looked at, right? But the point is, in those days, when you have Shlomo Melech and everyone is doing well, financially, economically, and people want to become Jewish, you doubt their motivation. They're coming in because they see that, you know, things are looking good on Wall Street over there, right? So that's why they're becoming Jewish. It's a whole issue by itself. So there's a lot to say about that. The whole conversion issue, which I'm trying to avoid, but you can't not deal with it to a certain extent. We'll just finish the last two psukim and then we'll be able to dive in. So listen to this. Where did they go? They came back to Beit Lechem. Everyone was wondering. Vatomarana, Zod Naomi, is this Naomi? Vatomaralem, Altikranali Naomi, Karenali Mara. She wants to use the name Mar, bitter. That was her shkofa. Everything that happened to her was bitter. Ki Hamar, Shaddai Li Ma'od, and the use of this name, Shaddai, which is the name of God, the Almighty, the idea of God in a sort of higher level, you know, which is a whole Malchut Shaddai. We say this every time we say Aleinu. The idea of the name of Hashem being used here is a serious comment of Naomi to say that God, Shaddai, who is so usually so plentiful, Dai, the Hebrew word, which means enough. God gives enough to the world. In this case, Hamar did to me all this bitterness. Not that she has a blame against God, but she's recognizing what happened. She says, I went out complete, I was full. God brought me back empty, not dismissing the fact that this was all from God. I heard a whole thing yesterday, Yom HaShoah. They have this famous interview with Elie Wiesel, which again is a very, very interesting interview. And ask him obviously about his connection, his religious views, and it's a very, very delicate subject. And she says, Lama tikrenali Naomi, why call me Naomi Hashem Anabi? God afflicted me for Shaddai Rali, and the mighty did bad to me. And that's where she uses the word Ra, which is interesting, only at the end here. But I think the word Mar is much more powerful and much more significant. The final pasuk, Atoshem Naomi v'Ruta Moavia, Kalota Imo Hashova b'Stei Moav. They both came back, Heima Bo Beit Lechem b'Tchilat K'tzir Sarim, And it was the beginning of the barley harvest, and I spoke about this last week in Shul, that the barley was the Korban HaOmer. And that's another connection here to the fact that we talk about this Sefer, connecting it to this time of year. Katsir Sorim, the barley harvest, referring to, obviously, just after Pesach, coming into the season of Shavuot, which obviously will be towards the end, if we have a reference to that, we'll see.
Why is she referred to as...
And that's back to the discussion. Again, she's never going to lose that title. She's never going to lose the fact that, at this point in time, as much as she might even consider herself to have been converted, to make that commitment, in the eyes of everybody else, Marvia, she's still the non-Jewish lady. And it's going to take a tremendous amount of persuasion, right, as it does probably throughout history, with converts to bring that particular perception.
You're not supposed to remind them, oh, you're a convert.
You're not supposed to remind them. No, the most incredible, I'll just end with this story. In Poland, there was a family, Catholic family, very wealthy, in a place called Lanzut, where there was a big Rebbe there. I think... forgotten now, it was normally Melech. It's near Lezhensk, and the family was landowners in Poland for years. They were the nobility, and one of the sons became Jewish, and this was an unbelievable tragedy for them. And you see the family symbol there. It's a line with all the different sons have lines going across, like you would make marks across a straight line, and the final son, the line is broken. Symbolically, the family broke that line representing the final son because he became Jewish. What happened to him is that he eventually, they brought a charge against him, the Polish authorities, and they burned him at the stake. Famous story. And the Vilna Gaon said that this neshama was such a pure neshama, and he writes about it in the Vilna Gaon. And the Gaon was not usually involved in these types of situations, but the Vilna Gaon makes a whole reference to him, the Ger Tzedek. I've forgotten the name of the Potocki or something like that. They even made a book about it. You can get this the story, the whole story about it. It's an unbelievable story. So again, the whole concept of conversion is something that is always been very difficult for us to accept. Tosfos says that converts make everybody look. What does it say? The Gemara says we look like tzaras. Koshim geim ketzapachas. Yeah, that converts are difficult as leprosy. So most of the rabbis, unfortunately, take that in a very negative way. But Tosfos says, no, Rabbi Avrom Ager, right? One of the Tosfos writers, he was a convert. He says, no, because the convert does things so sincerely, we all, in comparison to him, look like lepers. In other words, we don't do the religion well. The person who converts is much more sincere. And that's true. I mean, you find that. If it's done, if a conversion is accepted sincerely, Kabbalah's Ol Malchus Shemayim, wow, it's something very unique. So... Yeah. And already setting the scene that there's going to be a loophole here. Because the loophole is definitely...
Boaz, I think I remember reading that it was Boaz's Sanhedrin Bezdin that...
Began the process.
...codified the fact that it's Boaz.
Correct, but it was never established finally till Shmuel, much later. And it says Amasa ben Yetter came into the Beit HaMidrash. Imagine this. I might have mentioned this before. He came into the Beit HaMidrash and they were arguing about the kashrus of King David. So what did he do? He took a sword. Imagine this. It never happened today. He took a sword and he slammed the sword in the ground, right, in the earth. And he said, if anyone disagrees with this psak halacha, this is what's waiting for you, in this life. He was prepared to kill them on the spot because he was so determined that this halacha should be established because he knew David had to be absolutely kosher, the future Mashiach Hashem. That's it. Amasa. Amasa was one of the brothers of Yoav, David's nephew. And he makes, I mean, imagine that today in Beis Din. Wow, that would be a good story. If Shlomo had that in Beis Din today, I don't think he'd be, he would hang around for the results. It's just an unbelievable story. It would be incredible. As you can see, there's so much information. It's challenging, but I think we made a good start. I really do believe that. So thank you, everybody. Next.